in Waco, right hard that'll make it by dawn, cross the Brazos and Waco.
Welcome to the Waco History Podcast. I'm Randy Lane, great-grandson of Waco architect Roy E. Lane. Over 100 years ago, he designed the Alico Building, Hippodrome, and other well-known landmarks. My co-host, Dr. Stephen Sloan of Baylor's Institute for Oral History, is helping me learn Waco's known and unknown stories. On this episode, Waco's 9/11 response.
People are calling in on all sorts of suspicious vehicles, baggage in the parking lots at airports, suspicious people.
Historian Ty Williams explains why President Bush's nearby ranch in Crawford had Waco on high alert.
Talking to those guys, they were mentally ready to do what was necessary.
Cross the Brazos and Waco, ride hard, that'll make it by dawn. Cross the Brazos and Waco, I'm safe when I reach San Antonio.
Well, welcome back to the studio. We have a very special guest today. Stephen, do you want to introduce him?
I'll be happy to, Randy. Ty Williams, who's a local product, who has just completed his master's degree in history down at Texas State University. We haven't done anything on the 21st century yet, and it's amazing how time marches on. This is a history that everyone will have some connection to. It's interesting to think about how every national story really has a local element here, and we're going to be talking about September 11th attacks, and we all know the national story there, but it also intersects with lives locally here. And so Ty's done some research on this, and he has a family connection. I won't spoil that for him. He can tell you that, but he's here to talk about kind of some research he did into that story, and I'll let him tell you more about it.
Okay, Ty, can we start with just kind of introducing yourself to people? Who are you? What's your background?
Yes, my name is Ty Williams. I originally from Waco, Riker graduate, and I went to college much later on and in grad school down at Texas State. I studied early American history, primarily the American Revolution. And during graduate school, we had to take a public history courses, and I did a oral history class with Professor Dan Utley, who is a famous oral historian in Texas. And I decided to do a class project, and it kind of evolved into a pet project, a side pet project. And I was able to come up with a really fascinating idea of Waco has a tie directly to 9/11. And that tie is primarily with President Bush and his ranch at Crawford, just outside of town. It's probably 25 miles, 30 miles away from Waco. Mm-hmm. He liked to frequent that ranch, to a lot of people's understanding that that may have been one of the targets that was coming next, or could have been a target. And so I started doing some research on that and kind of seeing where it would take me, and had spoken with my father, Detective Joe Williams, otherwise known as Joe Bob to the PD community.
Joe Bob.
Joe Bob. That the SWAT team at the time was a full-time SWAT team, Special Weapons and Tactics, and they were on presidential duty, which is very rare, and or I think don't think in ever as has ever happened in presidential history. The municipal SWAT team had a presidential duty to aid Secret Service and protection of President Bush from the airport, at the ranch, and in the community. So I started talking to him, and it turns out that several of his partners and guys that he worked with on the team had some really interesting stories regarding the PD's involvement that day. And to me, that was a story that needed to be captured, because the 9/11 is kind of kicks off the 21st century, and everything that's happened since is a byproduct of that. Mm. And it's going to define the century. And so I think the local element here needs to be captured. And I was happy to be able to capture a small snippet of it thus far.
So putting together your story, where does it all kind of start for you?
Started for me, the connection that the SWAT team has and the guys that I've known for a while that I was able to interview. I moved towards interviewing them, asking them through officers' lives that day, that morning, what happened before, you know, what was their routine before the towers were hit? Mm-hmm. And then I kind of let them tell me what they did, let them unfold it to me. It was a normal day, just like it was for everybody. Mm-hmm. And then you flip on the TV or the radio, you know, we didn't really have cell phones to that point that we do today. And so news travels rather differently. And when they flipped on the TV, they knew something drastically different was happening that day. And they knew, that they are going to be doing something that no one's been done. For example, the SWAT team was doing their regular workouts in the gym. Mm-hmm. And someone had flipped on the TV and they saw that a tower had been hit. At that point in time, they kind of just like everybody was, shocked, disbelief. They were waiting on to see what would happen. You know, what was the next step? What was going to happen? At that point in time, Monroe Kralinski, I believe, was with a sergeant. and he told them all to stop their morning workouts and gear up, that this was going to be a different day for them.
So they knew right then that it was probably going to be something going on that was going to have them jump into action.
For sure. Usually they will serve high-risk warrants and provide assistance like that to the city and do major drug arrests and things like that. At this point, it morphed into something quite the opposite. They had to go into a more of a security stance. They had to start putting a bubble around Waco and protecting Waco. For example, one detective, Terry Mills, and his partner, forgot his name, they were ordered to go get the mayor. At that point in time, it was Robert Sheehy. He has since passed, so that oral history is gone. I would have loved to have that one back, but he has since passed away, I believe. And they went into his office, and he had no idea what was happening. They said, well, you have to come with us right now. No exceptions, no excuses. Those were their orders. We need to take you to the emergency management center. And once I heard that, I said, Waco has an emergency management center? Yes, they do. And at that point in time, it was located in the basement of City Hall.
Okay.
I'm not sure where it's at now, but who else in the emergency management center was the mayor, the city council, department heads, city administration staff, county people, legal counsel, things like that. Once they got everybody in one area, they had to kind of protect the emergency management center and set up a security circle around that. But of course, at this time, no one knows what's going on. To quote Terry Mills, the rumor mill kicked in. You know, we didn't know what was going to happen. We didn't know where the next attack was coming from. Is President Bush even coming to the ranch? They kind of, the Secret Service just kind of, as it all has unfolded over the past decades, now we kind of looked at it and said, oh, you know, no one really knew what was going to happen until it kind of just happened and they ordered him up into Air Force One. But at that time, no one knew.
Yeah, so giving a little context, just in case there's younger folks listening. So President Bush is at an elementary school in Florida, Sarasota, Florida.
That's right. I forgot about that.
Yeah, and as Michael Moore infamously, my pet goat, he's reading My Pet Goat to a class. He's notified, I think his first statements come there in Florida, but then they put him in the air. So yeah, they don't know where he's going. Nobody knows where he's going. And I think there's room locally to believe, in many respects, that Crawford could be that destination that he's heading to.
What the local community here and local PD knew here, that he was very comfortable at the ranch. And we now know that the nation knew that, that and the world knew that. He was very comfortable at his ranch, you know, also called the Western White House in Texas, a very similar LBJ type setting in Crawford. And they figured that the proximity, because he has to land in Waco and then be transferred by helicopter or by vehicle. And so they figured that that's where he would kind of come, because it's less dense, yet much more airspace you can control. It's just easier. You're next to the, you know, one of the world's largest military bases in Fort Hood. So it offers protection there. It just made kind of more sense to do that, but they decided to keep him in the air. That was more safer to do that. But at that time, everybody thought that he's most likely going to come to the ranch because it's a smaller style building that you can protect much easier that way.
And I think he's going to an area with less air traffic.
Absolutely.
So it's easy to vet kind of what the air traffic is around the space.
Absolutely. So,
yeah.
That's where they thought he was going. As the day slowly unfolds, the other tower gets hit, the Pentagon. One of the plane crashes in Pennsylvania. They don't really know if there are more attacks that are later on the day.
Right.
And so they are still at a very high level of mentally preparedness. And so they kind of started to shift and to say, okay, maybe he's not coming here. Talking to the SWAT officers that were kind of in brief conversations with the Secret Service, they didn't really even know. And so as that goes on, they have the orders come in from up above, the chief and assistant chiefs. They said, you know, we need to start securing the vital operations of Waco, the dam, the city hall, Waco Airport, electrical grid stations. Were all seen as possible targets from people that wanted to do harm or to start to make things more difficult for the president. So they started doing two-man security checks, and they would have to rotate and check these security areas, the high possible threat areas. And at that time, of course, there's panic, almost borderline public panic going on in the city. People are calling in on all sorts of suspicious vehicles, suspicious baggage in the parking lots at airports, suspicious people, but those calls were coming in. One such call was, I believe there was a Ryder truck, those transport trucks parked out in front of City Hall. The previous attack on the Twin Towers was done in a Ryder truck. So that kind of made some people very uneasy. And fortunately enough, the Ryder truck was empty. This was SWAT team over there, and they secured the truck and opened it, and nothing was in there.
Somebody picked the wrong day to move some desks.
You are not lying, man. Can you well, imagine?
Also, with thinking about Oklahoma City, I mean,
yeah, Timothy McVeigh.
There's precedent there, yeah.
He used that, I believe. Yeah. They're very well aware of what's happening, and they're trying to keep citizens calm. Patrols trying to do that as well. The SWAT team was not taking any warrants. They're not doing anything like that. They were just going to these security checks and constantly answering special calls. You know, we've had a few instances where the private planes took off from the airport or their private airports out in their land. And then about 3 minutes later or less than that, you have a fighter jet behind you. And then those people would have to get down and then they would send out someone to investigate why they were up in the air at all on when they grounded the planes. As that's kind of unfolding, their day is going by and it's not like it's going to let up. You know, they're not going to be able to stop and take a break and, oh, let's just, you know, let's just take 30 minutes to go grab that. And that's not really, they had to constantly be on edge and be prepared for what was going to happen next. And at that point in time, of course, we all know, and as I remember, no one really knew what was going to happen next. Back then, it took a while to get the news out. Most of these officers, when they, it ended up being about a 12, I think, to 15-hour day for them, in and out all the time, checking on constant things. Most of these officers live in the community and or surrounding area, and one such officer lives 15 minutes from Bush's ranch, and so he was worried about his family. You know, what was going to happen next? Most people thought that there's no way this is the end. They're going to keep coming the next day. When they went home, they had the same conversations as you did with your family. You understand now that the world is definitely going to change. It's moving in a vastly different direction, that this is unprecedented. Flying is going to be vastly different now. Mm-hmm. The world's going to change. What is the response going to be? Is America going to have a response? And so these are the type of things and conversations they were having with their family. Most of them didn't get much sleep, you know, rightfully so. I imagine they were very high in adrenaline and nervous, just like everybody was. I still get a little bit nervous when I read the tapes and watch shows about it. It still kind of gets you uneasy.
So to be clear, there was no actual situations in Waco and Bush didn't ever actually come.
Yeah, so I should have clarified. Yes, Bush never came. He did not come. I think he came a couple weeks later. Mm-hmm. But there was no credible threat of any kind other than fake bomb threats. There were a handful of those. But other than that, there were no credible threats, no threats at all, which was a great thing, you know.
Yeah, he leaves Florida, goes to Barksdale, outside Shreveport. Barksdale Air Force Base is where he lands. Makes statements there, and then he's in the air again, and then goes to Nebraska, I think.
I think something like that. Goes somewhere in the Midwest, and then, of course, he goes to Ground Zero, which we all, the famous speech, and made a lot of people nervous. I've watched a lot of documentaries on that, and that made a lot of people nervous that he was going to be there, but I think that was the right move.
Do you know when local authorities got word that wasn't a possibility? He wasn't coming to Central Texas.
I have yet to uncover exactly when that happened. Yeah. I believe as the Secret Service was going through the day, I don't think they were going to let anybody know anything.
Yeah.
And if they did, there may have been most likely disinformation for obvious reasons. As the day goes on, they could probably gather as much as, well, he's probably not going to come here as the day goes on. But they also thought maybe he would come here the next day or late at night, just show up at the airport. That was perceived as an option as well, that he might just show up and we'd have to just immediately go out there. Like I said, it was very much in the unknown. Makes those tensions and those...
Yeah, and kept them on alert.
I don't have any experience or I don't have any knowledge of his ranch there, but I do have a lot of experience on bases, and I would see why that would be a safer choice if you needed to land, because you can actually control all the entrances and exits and have a police force in place. And on a ranch, maybe kind of hard to control all the different areas by which people could come.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, because there's a spot right across from the ranch called the 11th Acre was kind of a rendezvous point where they would, Secret Service or the county or the SWAT, Waco SWAT, would meet. And that's where they would delegate protections and things like that. And after 9/11, the team, SWAT team, would go out and to the ranch, and then now you'd see a missile battery in the back or a Harrier jet sitting there ready and waiting. And then they expanded the no-fly zone and it would constantly, I remember just hearing those jets just fly 24 hours a day whenever he was in town at the ranch. For example, one trip within the Israeli president, I believe, came to visit him, and that's a high-value target towards the same people that he's perceived as a high-value target just as much as President Bush is.
Right.
And they did, like, it was like a 36 or 72-hour shift, I guess, or tour, constantly in security mode out there at the ranch. So they used the ranch to their advantage in a post 9/11 sense, and that's changed a lot of how protection's done. To my understanding, there's never been such a city police department involvement in the protection of a president than Waco PD has done in history of America.
Did you hear any interesting nuggets about how they protected him specifically that would be interesting to people? Like, I remember Dick Cheney came to my ship when I was in Japan, and Secret Service was out there 2 weeks before, and they were doing all sorts of checks, and then they were mentioning, you know, snipers on roofs and stuff like that. So I'm sure there's similar tactics involved.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, there's definitely, the Secret Service does a fantastic job at protecting the president. And I guess they should probably do better at dinner parties, I suppose. But when I was at the ranch, there's a base team that stays in Waco, a Secret Service office that's still here. It's still in Waco, believe it or not. And they would spend a couple of days in advance, and it would just constantly be on alert out there. And there's definitely snipers on rooftops. They would use Marine 1 and Marine 2 coming up and down. You don't know which one he's on. They would send motorcades down the road that didn't have anybody in it. Things like that. Absolutely. They took all necessary precautions and to ensure the president's safety in such a volatile time and just after 9/11. And since 9/11, the Waco PD has changed certain things of how they go about securing the city. They've implemented certain things. They've learned a lot from this scenario. Mm-hmm. If case a big emergency happened, you know, of any kind.
What are some things that involved, this shift in readiness?
I know there's just way more technology now, the preparedness, there's better plans. And, you know, New York, Chicago, those cities deal with, in LA,
yeah,
they deal with massive threats, you know, all the time. And, you know, London, for example, has that. But the city of Waco, I think, learned a lot that day, and it's been able to improve itself.
I'm sure it changes whenever you have some famous or important person in town, too. You have to think about, are there dangers to that person?
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. For example, the current events of like Chip and Joanna, I'm sure that they have probably a little bit of a security team.
There's snipers on the silos.
For sure. There are, you know.
That's why they got the silos.
They have the cupcakes there, so.
You can't go in there. It's because that's where they're basing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's right.
Exactly.
What Randy was trying to get at earlier is rumors and conjecture that Joe Bob wouldn't want you to share, that maybe stories about just interactions maybe with the protection team, with the Bush presence here and that sort of thing. That's what he's getting at.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
He's apparently not as good as I am.
Yeah.
Okay. The SWAT team was obviously in close relationship with the Secret Service through these 8 years. I mean, they still have a relationship to some degree with the Secret Service when Bush does come to the ranch, but he doesn't really come that much often anymore. But I know they would train together, and there would be this good old boy training type stuff and the type of shooting contests and things like that. Mm-hmm. There's a few interesting stories. They do elude me at the moment, but I know there was a shooting contest. Let's put it this way. Old Joe Bob won that one.
Of course he's going
to
say that.
He wants you to tell that story. Yeah.
There's a lot of those unique stories, and there's a picture I believe all the officers got signed by Bush. There's a picture of them standing with President Bush and that they got, and that was very special to them. They did get to be in close proximity to the president and other foreign leaders, military and political leaders. So there's a lot of unique memories they have. I wish I could have transported myself back in a couple of years after and gotten those memories when they were happening, as all oral historians probably would would wish that they could do that, you know, at the time. Some of the stuff has been lost. It's unfortunate, but the memories are definitely out there. So this is definitely an ongoing project. This is not done. The other day, I having dinner, and I ran into a Secret Service agent that was a part of that detail, and we chatted, and he was real ardent about wanting to get an oral history and have me talk to him about that day and kind of capture that. So that was neat. It's kind of coming full circle. It's always staying with me. So it definitely will be an ongoing, consistent project for years to come. I think I'd like to get it fully captured and maybe write something about that. Maybe publish something about
that. So if someone's listening, they can contact the show.
They can contact the show.
Well, you were sharing earlier before we started recording just some experiences you got to have, you know, going on Air Force One or seeing Air Force One. And can you share some of those?
Yeah. So my dad calls me or does call my mom and says, you know, what's Ty doing today? It's football practice. Whatever.
How old were you?
I don't know.
Teenager.
16, 17, somewhere around there.
Okay.
Late teenagers. And so he said, why don't you get dressed properly and come out to the airport at TSDC? And he told me where to park. And I said, okay.
What's proper dress for this?
Yeah. You know, right? What is? Do I need a black suit and tie? What do I need to wear? So anyways, I get out there and he goes, I sent a Secret Service agent who's going to come talk to you. I can't remember the guy's name. I know his face, but I can't remember his name. Comes out there. He says, are you Joe Bob's son? I said, yes, I'm Ty Williams. He goes, okay. He goes, let me see your ID. So he gives me my ID. I give him my ID. He says, okay. And he goes, give me knives, weapons, guns, keys on you.
That took a while. Yeah.
Yeah, it took. So I had to unload all that stuff.
An hour later.
Yeah. No, but shockingly enough, he did take my keys. He did take my keys. Definitely. He didn't pat me down or anything, but he definitely made sure I had everything in my pockets. I got to get beyond the rope and beyond the media and go walk around Air Force One. I couldn't get on at that point in time. I think there was something secret that they wouldn't let me know. But no, I got to see a lot of Air Force One from the ground very, very close up. That was exciting. But that was really neat. I saw President Bush. I got to see a sitting president. Believe it or not, very few people actually get to see a sitting president. It's a very small portion of the population, any sitting president. There was a poll done, I think, and it was less than 2% or something like that, or less than 1% actually get to see a sitting president. So that was nice. I got to see him at a 20-yard distance. I gave him a wave. I made sure
nice.
He knew who I was.
Good, he gave you a wink.
He gave me a wink. Yeah, finger guns, and I gave him a fist bump, and we high-fived. No. But that would have been fantastic, but no. But I did get to see him at a decent distance.
What do you think and this is for, so many people are new to Waco the last 20 years, and so they may have less understanding of this, but what do you think the impact of, that sort of proximity and having Camp David,
right? Yeah.
I mean, in many respects, right outside of Waco, what do you think the broader impact that had on Waco itself?
I believe it situates Waco in American history. For those 8 years, Waco's in a very interesting spot next to the Western White House. And I think also Crawford, Texas, situates that in American history, in the history of America. It's what it stands for. Waco is that is something that your town was able to protect itself and aid the nation if it was going to be called to protect a president or to do what needed to be done, that your officers were prepared, ready, and standing ready to do whatever was necessary if they needed it to be done. Talking to those guys, they were mentally ready to do what was necessary, laying down their life or doing something quite unusual. They were wanting to be a part of this. They were wanting to do something. A lot of people felt helpless that day. That's also what I've gathered. Everybody wanted to do something, but what can you do at that point in time? I think it's a fantastic, very unique story. 9/11, I've been to the memorial during this project, and it kind of makes it, the connection, real.
Mm-hmm. With the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, it also becomes a point of protest or a place of protest. And,
correct.
And I don't know what role local law enforcement may have had in that, or if any of the guys you interviewed talked about that.
I do know in passing, we didn't discuss too much about that, but over the years there, I've heard stories that people would obviously try to go protest or get lost in a back road, and boy, that's a wrong back road to get lost on.
Yeah,
for sure, there were people who would protest in the town of Crawford, closest to the ranches they could get, and at the airport, to my understanding, there were protests. I didn't see any protesting when I was there, very much so. There were definitely protests.
What was W's favorite place to get a burger in Waco?
Man, I don't know, but if I was a guessing man, if it was...
You can't do that.
Yeah,
no,
I mean...
Don't just guess.
Yeah, I mean...
Your favorite burger place?
Do I do a plug right now?
Yeah, no, we are an unsponsored enterprise. Yeah,
he's a Captain Billy Whizbang guy, I think, for sure. Oh. Was that around back then? I don't know.
Oh, for sure it was.
We're looking for sponsorship, so if you would like to be... We're going to have Ty recording several different names of burger places, and if you'll send us money, he'll insert that here.
I can do that.
As someone who's not from Texas, what's the connection for W to Crawford? Is that like the family is from that part of town or?
No.
And he goes there sometimes still, yes. But it's not a place where he's at very often anymore.
No, not anymore, no.
So Bush bought the ranch, and of course the official name of it is the Prairie Chapel Ranch. He bought the ranch in 99, right after earning $14.3 million from the sale of the Texas Rangers. So this is when he was governor of Texas. He bought the land. And so there's not a long family connection to the land. Mm-hmm. I remember a lot of video of him clearing mesquite.
Yeah.
And things like that. You would see, they would have video.
It's very, Jeffersonian and Andrew Jackson type of imagery of
too. Manly man.
Yeah. I mean, the man of the people.
Taking care of the land.
Absolutely. Yeah. There's a lot of those images from the ranch that are in American history. I went to Bush's presidential library
in Dallas.
Yeah. In Dallas. And I got to nosy around that thing. And there's a lot in there. It's really neat. Mm-hmm. A lot about the ranch. A lot about, of course, 9/11. I suggest going to see it if you're ever in the Dallas area. It's really interesting.
We're missing the obvious sponsor for this episode, Bush's Chicken. That's where
absolutely.
He went.
Absolutely.
That was his favorite place to eat.
Done. Lock that one down.
Well, thanks very much for coming on the show. I've learned a ton, and actually, I want to go check out the ranch now, as close as I can get.
I assume at one point in our lifetime, it will be a museum, so... I'm sure, just close like LBJ is now, I'm sure that will be one day be a museum. Hopefully we all get to go out there and check it out.
Yeah. Thanks, Ty.
You're most welcome.
Cross the Brazos and Waco, ride hard, that'll make it by dawn. Cross the Brazos and Waco.
Thanks for listening to the Waco History Podcast. Like what you heard? Subscribe, rate, and review our show on iTunes so we can reach more listeners. You can find show notes and info on every episode at wacohistorypodcast.com and more info on Waco's past at wacohistory.org. Our theme music, used with permission, is Cross the Brazos at Waco, performed by the late Billy Walker. For more info on Billy's music, go to billywalker.com. We'll see you next time.
Time ago, as he dropped the guns that she hated in the muddy Brazos below. Cross the Brazos at Waco, ride hard, that'll make it by dawn. Cross the Brazos at Waco, I'll walk straight in old San Antone. Then the night came alive with gunfire. He knew that at last it had been found. As the ranger's badge showed brightly, El Bandito lay on the ground. Carmela knew he was dying, that all of her dreams were in vain. As she kissed his lips for the last time, she heard him whisper again, cross the Brazos and Waco, ride hard, that'll make it by dawn. Cross the Brazos and Waco, I'm safe when I reach San Antone. I'm safe when I reach San Antone.